Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this hour, at the worlds of economics and politics. A reminder, if you pledged during our recent fund drive and haven't yet sent in your check, please do. And if you didn't pledge, well, it's never too late. Visit the website at kpfa.org and make your pledge securely online. And if you've already done all those wonderful things, well, thank you very much. Okay, two guests up today. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear from Erica Seifert, who's a researcher with Greenberg Quinlan Rossner, on the mood of the American public. A hint, they're angry about inequality and how Wall Street has been getting away with, if not quite murder, something close to it. And then at the bottom of the hour, Dorian Warren, a political scientist at Columbia's School of International and Public Affairs, puts Occupy Wall Street in historical context as a classic social movement. Before all that, some comments in the news. First, I recorded the interview with Dorian Warren, that we'll hear in the second half of this show, before the great Oakland actions of earlier this week. I don't have much to say about those since I was quite far away, except this. Wow. Thank you. I'm in awe and in your debt. You're an inspiration. On a much less thrilling level, a few words on the October employment report, which was released on Friday morning. This was one of those could-have-been-worse things, of which life is often full. Overall, employers added 80,000 jobs last month. That headline number was dragged down by the loss of 24,000 government jobs, mostly at the local level, meaning that private employers added just over 100,000 jobs. That's certainly better than nothing, but it barely keeps up with population growth, much less making a dent in the massive number of jobs lost during the Great Recession. We're over 6 million in the hole on that score. In fact, at this rate, it would take about 7 years just to make those lost jobs up, without even allowing for population growth. Really repairing the damage done to the job market would take something like 2 or 3 times the October number every month for years to come, and that doesn't seem to be in the offing. A bright spot, however, total employment is finally higher than it was 10 years ago, the first month you could say that about in more than 2 years. That ends the first period of long-term employment contraction we'd seen since the 1930s. We're getting off the mat, but hardly standing, and certainly not sprinting. Also, there is a downscale skew to the jobs that were created. Stronger sectors included temp firms, retail, and bars and restaurants, mostly pretty low-wage things. Average hourly earnings rose just 0.2%, or 1.8% for the year, a slower rate of growth than we saw earlier this year, and barely enough to keep up with inflation. These numbers come from a survey of 300,000 employers. A simultaneous survey of 60,000 households painted a somewhat brighter picture. The unemployment rate fell 0.1 point, from 9.1 to 9.0. The broader U6 rate, which includes people working part-time who'd rather work full-time, and those who've dropped out of the labor force because they've given up on finding a job, that fell 0.3 point from 16.5 to 16.2. That's a much more accurate picture of what joblessness is like, and it's still a very high number, although a little off its peaks. The share of the adult population working rose 0.1 percentage point. That figure, the so-called employment population ratio, is far below its all-time peak a decade ago, more than 6 percentage points below, in fact. Getting back to that level of 2000-2001 would require the creation of 15 million new jobs. At current rates of job creation, it would take 16 years to reach that figure, again, not allowing for population growth. That deficit, the 15 million job deficit, is far larger than the 6 million jobs we lost during the recession, because job growth was incredibly slow even during the mid-2000s expansion. The labor market is sick, very sick, and hardly getting much better. One of the nicer things that you can say about this month's report is that it does keep fears of a double-dip recession at bay. and it looks positively booming next to, say, Spain, which has lost the U.S. equivalent of 2 million jobs over the last 5 months. But it's still pretty weak. Along with the Occupy Wall Street movement has grown up a Move Our Money campaign pushed by a group calling itself the New Bottom Line. It takes off from a brainchild of that great exploiter of unpaid journalistic neighbor at her eponymous post, Arianna Huffington. Arianna's scheme would have us, those of us with money in large banks, move it to small ones. This touches on a foundational populist fantasy that virtue and size are inversely related. When Huffington unveiled her scheme, I took advantage of the gadget on her website that allowed you to enter your zip code, and it came back with a suggested list of virtuous, meaning small, banks. I thought I'd look into some of the suggestions that emerged when I entered that zip code, 11238. One suggestion was the black-owned Carver Federal Savings Bank. In recent years, Carver has been a major financer of the gentrification of previously predominantly black neighborhoods in Brooklyn and Queens. As those neighborhoods get richer, Carver boasts, it's been partnering with Merrill Lynch, a subsidiary of the Bank of America, by the way, to offer wealth management services to flusher new residents. Another one of Arianna's suggestions, Apple Savings Bank, has about three-quarters of its assets in U.S. Treasury bonds, not local loans. They don't come much bigger than the U.S. Treasury. And a third suggestion, the New York Community Bank, which even features that sacred word in its name, financed a private equity group that bought up a lot of apartment buildings in New York during the boom in the hope of squeezing out the rent-regulated tenants and replacing them with more lucrative ones paying market rents. With the real estate bust, the private equity firm had trouble servicing its debts, and the residents of the buildings that it bought are suffering as services are cut further and tenants harassed more intently. There's a fundamental problem with these small as beautiful schemes. Many small banks have more money than they can profitably invest locally. As Barbara Garson showed in her wonderful book, Money Makes the World Go Around, the portion of the book advance that she deposited in a tiny upstate New York bank was almost certainly lent by the Fed funds market to Chase, where it entered the global circuit of capital. This is not at all uncommon. Money is fungible, protean, and highly mobile, even when it looks locally rooted. That very mutability is part of what makes money so valuable. It's the ideal form of general wealth that can be instantly turned to caviar, lodging, Swedish massage, erotic massage, or shares of Google. It rarely stays put. The New Bottom Line people are pushing credit unions along with small banks. Many credit unions are fine little enterprises, but they too have the more money than they know what to do with problem. A look at the federal stats on credit unions reveals that about two-thirds of their assets are in loans, mostly for cars and houses, but a third of their assets are parked in cash and investments. What that means isn't specified exactly, but it's almost certainly Treasury and federal agency bonds like Ginnie Mae's. Again, anything but small and local. And should the credit unions get an influx of money, it's highly likely that most of it would go to these sorts of bonds. There's no way that they could accommodate even a small fraction of our near $8 trillion in bank deposits without turning to big-time securities or Merrill Lynch wealth management schemes. Getting banks under control is a matter of politics, not individual portfolio allocation decisions. Move your money, and it's still money. Let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to take the temperature of American public opinion.
Thank you.
Now, some of Béla Bartók's String Quartet No. 5, the fourth movement, performed by the Emerson String Quartet. My first guest is Erica Seifert, a researcher with the public opinion firm Greenberg Quinlan Rossner Research and its affiliate Democracy Corps. The Greenberg is Stanley Greenberg, who was once a political scientist, a Marxist of some sort, actually, who evolved into Bill Clinton's pollster. But his history is still visible in the work he does, safely liberal mostly, and even consults for BP. But he still asks interesting questions about class and economic power. For the last several years, Greenberg et al. Have been reporting mounting public anger at the American political and economic system, anger aimed mostly at the rich and powerful. Their latest poll, Winning the Economic Argument, was aimed at persuading Democrats to take more, dare I say, populist positions. I'm always nervous around the word populist, in part because it's a slippery thing and can often break right, meaning anti-poor, as well as left, meaning anti-rich. But today's mood is, as we'll hear shortly, not anti-poor at all, unlike the 1970s and 1980s. Here's Erica Seifert. Welcome, Erica Seifert. So it looks like you've got some mixed messages in coming from the people you've studied here. Winning the economic argument, there seems to be some appeal to debt reduction, but also some appeal to long-term infrastructure investment and such. So what are the American people thinking?
Well, I think that this economy is obviously really difficult, especially for the middle-class people who have a hard time seeing how this gets fixed. And debt is certainly a part of it, but they don't just think about it in terms of the national debt. So personal debt plays a huge role in what they're thinking about as an overall culture of debt that they believe contributed to the economic crisis in the first place.
Their own or other people's or a mix of both?
Both. So in our data, we found that of their top three concerns, two of them actually had to do with home financing. Responsible homeowners with mortgages underwater, 94% of people think that that's a big concern. And then a quarter of homeowners owing more on their homes than they're even worth and struggling with debt that's so big that they can't sell or move out of their homes, 93%. So, I mean, that's almost all of the voting population thinking these are big concerns.
It's pretty unusual that you find 93% of people agreeing on anything, isn't it?
I haven't really seen numbers like these, to be honest with you. I mean, this is a big concern for a lot of people, I think, because they don't see how the economy grows as long as individuals are weighed down by this kind of debt, so then they can't contribute to the economy. But they also look at the national debt, and I think a lot of people tend to think of the national debt in terms of their own experiences with personal debt. And I think it makes it really hard for them to understand how the country's economy grows as long as it's weighed down by debt.
Let's step back a bit. Do people have any kind of narrative or understanding of how we got into this mess, how all that debt came to be?
Yeah, sure. I think that they have a pretty sophisticated understanding of the home mortgage crisis because so many of them are now wrapped up in it themselves, even responsible homeowners. But when it comes to the national debt, when we ask people about what programs should be cut in order to decrease the deficit, they tend to think that there are very few programs that we can spare. I think a lot of people think that the national debt comes from waste. Because there are a lot of programs that they're unwilling to give up. And I think that they think that since really 2001, the country has just lived in a culture of debt, an overarching culture of debt.
2001 being the first Bush administration.
Sure, yeah. Those who are old enough to remember the surpluses that ended the Clinton administration, I think they sort of think about this as a decade-long problem, this being 2011.
And then how do they understand the genesis of the problems, the tax cuts, the wars, what drove the indebtedness?
Yeah, we didn't test that in this survey, but in the past, sure, they think about two wars. They think about tax cuts on the wealthiest, and honestly, they also blame themselves and their neighbors when it comes to personal debt and this overall pervasive culture of debt. But that wasn't part of the survey.
On the issue of personal debt, do they see them as themselves as borrowing to live beyond their means or under pressure from stagnant incomes? How do they understand what drove them into this borrowing mania?
Again, that wasn't part of this survey, but I think that we're seeing this corner turn. So overall the strongest problem in this didn't have to do with homeowners who are irresponsible or living beyond their means, but the effect on responsible homeowners whose mortgages are now underwater as a result of the housing bubble burst. So I think that that's a really striking corner that we've turned. So it's no longer about irresponsible lenders and borrowers. I mean, these two of the top three problems were about responsible homeowners who now can't move.
Well, an awful lot of people just had no choice. I mean, they face this enormous problem of housing inflation, and what would they do to afford a place to live? I mean, it wasn't a matter of irresponsibility, was it?
Right, yeah, and that's not what we're seeing here at all. This is absolutely about responsible homeowners whose who now own more in their mortgages than their homes are worth. So this isn't about irresponsibility, but we do hear a lot of times in focus groups people talking about this culture of debt that existed for the last decade. This is not certainly not about irresponsible homeowners. We're talking about 93% and 94% thinking that this is a serious problem. Both of those questions talk about responsible homeowners.
And then on the national level, when we talk about a culture of debt, they seem not to be able to point to any specific profligate spending except maybe the wars. So when you probe specifically, what kinds of solutions do people offer to this problem?
Well, one of their other biggest issues, and this is, again, 93% with 62% saying it's a very serious problem, 93% saying a serious problem. This is our number two problem. It says, in 2008, American taxpayers spent $7 billion bailing out Wall Street banks. That same year, Wall Street bankers received over $18 billion in bonuses. And that's, again, 93% saying that that's a serious problem. So I think that there is a great deal of anger right now targeted at Wall Street when it comes to where our money went.
And it goes beyond the question of mortgage securities to the broad culture of Wall Street?
Yeah, absolutely. So when we look at how Wall Street fares in this poll, the results are not pretty. So we tested Wall Street and then separately banks and financial institutions. 60% give each of those a cool, unfavorable rating. Only 20% rate them warmly. And three quarters or more of all voters are saying that we should prosecute and jail those who are responsible for the mess on Wall Street. That's 77% saying that we need to prosecute and jail those who were responsible. And that's a pretty significant number.
I'd like to know that 23% are who don't think so. The Republicans do gain some traction with the talk of irresponsible spending, however, don't they?
Sure, yeah. That's a very strong message for the Republicans. And I think that that speaks to voters' concerns about government spending and it being wasteful. Of course, when we get into specific issues, and we didn't test them in this poll, but more often than not, voters say that they don't want to cut any one of these programs. But when Republicans focus on responsibility, they gain a lot of traction because they think it encompasses what a lot of people see. At the same time, the Democratic message that scores equally as well talks about, sort of frames it in responsibility in terms of, you know, middle class economy. And that Democratic message says our economy is upside down. The majority of America is in recession, but Wall Street is doing better than ever. Regular people work harder and harder for less and less, while Wall Street CEOs enjoy bigger bonuses than ever. If America's economy isn't working for the 99%, it's not working. And I think to some extent, both of those top messages are about responsibility in different ways.
I'm speaking with Erica Seifert of Greenberg Quinlan Rossner Research in D.C. If we go back a couple of decades, a lot of people would complain about poor folks being parasites and being a drag on the economy and being a drag on the middle class. Do you see anything like that now, or is it mostly are they looking upwards on the ladder?
We did test something similar. We tested what some Republicans have been saying about people who don't pay taxes, the 40% who don't pay taxes or who make money off taxes, and it didn't gain much traction. It was one of the lowest in our battery. So I wouldn't say that it has no appeal, but I think a lot of people don't buy it, and it's certainly one of the lowest things that we tested.
And I'm guessing that's something like Herman Cain's argument that the unemployed are to blame for their own problems. That probably is not very popular either.
Sure. I would guess not.
When people talk about debt, I mean, how much of their feeling is really what we'd call an economic analysis, and how much of it is some sort of, you know, moral sense of irresponsibility, of things being out of control?
Sure, I think it's both, and I think that that's why the message centered on responsibility does so well. I do think that people worry about spending and waste and irresponsibility, for sure. I think part of it is also fear. I mean, this is a really scary time for a lot of people who don't see how and when we come out on the other end. So I think it's a combination. You know, they look at Greece, and then they look at what happens to individuals when they get into too much debt, and they are worried about the country in the same position. Whether or not that's correct economic theory, I think you can't blame people for being scared. I'm looking at the Democratic arguments, and I see that there is a way to frame this in a progressive way that isn't about cutting, which is what people don't want, for sure, cutting the programs they depend on most that are going to help Americans in this tough economy.
Whether this deficit super commission is likely to, is able to come up with anything is probably an open question, but you know, there is a likelihood it's going to propose cuts to Medicare and Social Security. How do those play?
We did not test a robust battery of Medicare and Social Security questions in this survey, but I can tell you that every time we've tested those, it's a pretty big loser.
Is there any kind of austerity that resonates, any kind of cuts that do resonate?
No, I mean, most people think of how we got into this as waste and excess spending. So for sure, two wars, tax cuts, raising taxes on the wealthiest are hugely popular. And then, of course, the bailouts are not popular at all. But in terms of the programs that affect people in their everyday lives, like education funding or Social Security and Medicare or housing policy, those things are not popular cuts at all. I mean, for some people, it's a matter of survival, right?
What about letting the Bush tax cuts expire, which are heavily skewed towards the upper brackets?
Yeah, I mean, we didn't test specifically letting the Bush tax cuts expire in this survey. What we did test was increasing taxes on the wealthiest, and we tested a 5% millionaire surtax, and both of those are popular. We did not test letting the Bush tax cuts expire for everyone, however.
But soaking the fat boys, as they said in All the King's Men, is a pretty popular agenda?
Sure. I mean, I think that a lot of people see this growing inequality, and it is troubling for a lot of people whose economic theory is based on middle-class purchasing power.
Now, in the past, it's been said that Americans don't care that much about inequality. You can get contradictory results in that. I've seen polls that say they do and polls that say they don't. But it seems that your current research shows that they are quite disturbed by it.
Yeah, and I think that we were even a little bit surprised by how strong these results were. So people are worried not only about mortgage debt and about the bailouts, but they're also worried about inequality itself. So, for example, over three quarters say that it's a serious problem, that tax rates for the richest 400 Americans were sliced in half as their income quadrupled, and they're now paying just 17%. 84% are worried about college tuition and fees and what that does for people who don't make enough money to pay it outright. And then if we look at 85% saying that it's a serious problem, that in the first year of the economic crisis, average workers lost 25% of their savings in IRA accounts, while the wealthiest 400 increased their wealth by $300 billion. So the inequality piece is coming through pretty strong here. We usually think anytime you have over 50% of people agreeing with something, it's pretty strong. We're looking at over three quarters saying that all of these things are serious problems.
And are there any partisan patterns to this? I mean, I would imagine that Democrats are more likely to be concerned about these issues, but do you find independents and Republicans also expressing concerns?
More independents. Obviously, when we're looking at the things that are getting 93% support, that's pretty much across the board. There aren't too many Republicans even disagreeing with this. But yeah, I mean, independents are pretty strong on all of these. It's not just Democrats.
As for a way out, you also investigated some sort of investment program. Did you get very specific? What do you mean by investments?
No, this is a question that we have been tracking over time. And we ask people about long-term deficit reduction over time versus long-term investment over time. And so we've been tracking it. So it's a plan to dramatically reduce the deficit over the next 5 years versus a plan to invest in new industries and rebuild the country over the next 5 years. So it's a long-term kind of thing. And a plan to invest in new industries and rebuild the country over the next 5 years outperforms a plan to dramatically reduce the deficit over the next 5 years. And of course, those two things are not necessarily mutually exclusive, but between the two, the fact that investing in new industries and rebuilding the country is doing better, I think tells us a lot about how people think about debt. They don't think about deficit reduction as something that should be a program of slashing and burning, the programs that mean the most to them and that will help us survive and even come out of this economy ahead.
Yeah, we cut taxes so that private equity titans could get another private jet, not in build industries of the future. A lot of what you're saying now kind of resonates with the themes of, broadly speaking, Occupy Wall Street. Do you notice any influence of that on your research?
So a lot of these things we hadn't tracked before, these inequality pieces. I can say that the strength of these things, I think that maybe awareness has been increased by Occupy Wall Street. I think that putting drawing attention to it or putting a light on it has made a lot of people probably think about the state of the economy.
Finally, I mean, I think given that we have a two-party system, it's quite possible that voters just say, you know, they blame the incumbent and don't really think about the agenda behind voting for the other guys. Does this work and suggest what we might see in next year's election?
Sure. I mean, of course, there's anti-incumbent, anti-Washington sentiment, and it's pretty clear. It's resulted in more voters saying they either don't know for whom they will vote, for which candidate they will vote, or saying that they'll vote for someone who's not one of the two major party candidates. I think a lot is sure to change between now and the election, and I think almost all of it's going to depend on the economy. In our regression models, the votes were the strongest drivers of the votes were the economy, the state of the economy. So I think that a lot will change, and it will probably end up being the economy that's driving it.
Oh, and I know I said finally, but this really is finally. What you're talking about, is this polling or focus group work or both?
I'm talking about the poll.
Uh-huh. But yeah, and your focus groups, are they saying rather similar things?
We haven't done a focus group on the vote in a while, but...
No, but the broad themes of inequality and Wall Street and those sorts of things.
Sure, yeah. There's a lot of anger about political institutions and financial institutions in general. Yeah, there's a lot of anti-establishment sentiment right now.
That was Erica Seifert, a researcher with Greenberg Quinlan Rossner Research and its affiliate Democracy Corps. You can find Greenberg Quinlan Rossner Research on the web at gqrr.com and the Democracy Corps at democracycorps.com. Corps, of course, C-O-R-P-S, not C-O-R-E. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web at kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back with Dorian Warren after a musical break. Thank you. That was the second movement of Haydn's Piano Sonata No. 32, part of the wonderful collection of the complete Haydn sonatas performed by Jenő Jandó. And apologies if I'm slaughtering the Hungarian. My next guest is Dorian Warren, a professor of political science at the School of International and Public Affairs of Columbia University. Dorian Warren has researched and written on race, class, urban affairs, labor organizing, and social movements. His interests make him a perfect candidate for talking about how Occupy Wall Street fits in with the history of social movements and how it speaks to the current American political scene. Dorian Warren. Welcome, Dorian Warren. We've had a rising inequality in this country for something on the order of 35 years. Why has it practically overnight become such a salient political issue, do you think?
Well, I think in terms of the overnightness of Occupy Wall Street, I actually tend to view it in terms of a longer cycle, movement cycle. So I think to understand Occupy Wall Street, we have to go back to at least 1999 and the battle in Seattle, which was, you know, a conflict over the role of global financial institutions and global inequality. And I think that could be seen as a starting point, potentially, of this decade-long frustration with growing inequality. And then you fast forward to, of course, the Arab Spring, to what happened in February in Wisconsin, and then we get to Occupy Wall Street. I think there had always been frustration with growing inequality, with people losing their jobs, with wage stagnation, with all those things. And there were other efforts, to be honest, of organizations and people trying to start something. So there was a 98% movement that was tried to get started a few months ago, and it didn't take off. So, you know, a combination of luck, but already existing grievances, I think, is the reason why we see this explosion all of a sudden.
And one thing about Seattle was that the WTO, to most Americans, is a fairly abstract thing. A lot of the concerns were also not what you'd call day-to-day bread-and-butter concerns. Now it's really come around to basic stuff. Does that make a difference? How much of a difference does that make?
Yeah, I think you hit on something there in terms of the framing of those, of the difference in framing between the battle in Seattle and Occupy Wall Street. What's interesting about Occupy Wall Street, it is a populist frame to it. The "we are the 99% frame really is broadly inclusive of everybody, right? And it sort of creates this collective identity that everybody is losing out relative to the 1%. Whereas in the battle in Seattle was a much more, as you put it, abstract, you know, global capitalism is screwing the world, and that's not something that's going to get, you know, millions of people to go out and protest. It got a large number of people to go out and protest, but the usual suspects, people on the left, the labor movement, you know, who care about these things. But I think the framing of Occupy Wall Street and the fact that it's not a temporary, you know, Wall Street's not a temporary target, unlike the meetings of the WTO, it's not going anywhere. And so the occupation of that physical space also has resonance, I think, for people.
Now, that 99%, there's certainly statistically true that the top 1% have really been raking it in. The bottom 99% have not been doing anywhere near as well. But when you break it down under the surface, you know, there's certainly differences and distinctions among that 99%. How important are those, or should we just sort of try to efface those under the banner of the 99% in the interests of unity and solidarity?
I think we should try to take the 99% as far as it goes, to be honest, because I think precisely because it was such a broad framing, that's why this has been so successful initially. It is true that the top 1% have been driving, and in fact the top 10th of 1% have been really driving the growing inequality the last 30 years, and that's really concentrated in the financial sector in New York City. So I do think there is an empirical truth to the claim about the 1%. But I think more broadly, and this is true of all populist movements, the elite in some way are always targeted. And in this case, the target is the 1% versus everyone else. It is true that the top 10% arguably are fine, right? So maybe it should be the 89% or something, or the 90%. But I think thus far, because of the success of the frame of the 99%, I think we should take it as far as it goes. But once demands start coming up, and I'm someone that doesn't think there should be demands anytime soon, but once the processes, the democratic processes start playing out and different Occupy groups start coming up with demands, then I think that's the point where they need to be sensitive to what are the differences between people at the 50% and down range versus those in the top 10%.
Well, one of the things, I mean, I want to get back to the demands issue in a moment, but one of the things about focusing on the 99 is that the upper middle class doesn't feel like it's going to be hit with significantly higher taxes. I mean, is that something to worry about, to try to like shield the professional class and really focus on the super elite?
Well, yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, again, I think it's going to depend on what the concrete policy demands will be. But as an organizing principle, I think it does mobilize people, and it could potentially create a sense of solidarity between the upper middle class and the working class and the poor that I think has actually been lacking in the last 30 years. When you look at public opinion polls and you look at it by income, are people supportive of, say, greater redistribution? There are splits in terms of higher income earners versus those that are in the working class or poor folks. So I think at the moment it actually serves as a principle of solidarity in some way, linking, you know, the upper middle class with the working class and the lower middle class and the poor. But yes, I mean, do I want a millionaire's tax? Yes. Do I think, you know, people in the top 10%, which is probably around, I don't know, 150,000 actually, or close to 200,000, should they pay higher taxes? Actually, yeah.
The sort of professional managerial class, or at least the managerial class, or the middle managerial subclass, or whatever you call it, is finding itself vulnerable to the kinds of labor market disruptions that the working class found itself hit by 20, 25 years ago. Does that change the politics of this?
I think so. I think that's why the 99% meme has resonated so broadly, precisely because for the longest time, when bad things happened to people economically, I think the professional middle class assumed that they were immune to those economic misfortunes. And I think it's precisely the fact that in this global economy and our policy choices, the fact that they're feeling the exact same thing as the working class, as the lower middle class, as poor folks, as the unemployed, I think is actually very useful to create a sense of solidarity that, no, you're not vulnerable and you're not unlike everybody else. The same economic and social and political forces affecting the vast majority of people in this country and around the world also affect you, and you're going to have to make a decision on whose side are you on in this fight.
Yeah, I've heard an analysis of revolutions or, you know, major social transformations that says that they can really happen when you have kind of disgruntled and semi-employed intellectual class, people with some degree of privilege, getting together with the working class and the really dispossessed. Is that kind of commonness of misfortune really explosive potentially?
I think so. I mean, you know, the example that comes to mind, obviously, is the Cuban Revolution. You know, Che and Fidel weren't poor, right? They were definitely middle class, if not upper middle class, in terms of their background. And we do know that in lots of movements, those that were most radical were from the middle class and the upper middle class, right? They were in some ways highly educated and had either a strong sense of injustice, or they felt something personally in terms of the economic forces affecting them. So I do think this is a promising moment that in some ways we've been waiting for a very long time, where everybody is pissed off and everybody just about can get engaged in some way in terms of channeling that anger in some way to fundamentally transform our political system and hopefully our economic system.
This thing has gotten really remarkable traction in the discursive realm. We were watching CNN the other night, and just, you know, regular CNN guys talking about how you have to pay attention to this thing. It's really, and they talked about it for some length of time. The New Yorker cover the other week was rich people holding up signs saying they're going to protect the status quo and their privilege, but it's as if it's just become so central that everyone has to comment on it. Is this, I mean, how unusual is something like that?
I think that's probably one of the most important things that social movements do. They force issues on the national agenda and a national political discourse that media, that either political party, that most of the elite never want to talk about. That's always a success of a social movement. So already I think this is a successful movement because it didn't die out in terms of the national political conversation. I was talking to a producer at NBC Nightly News a couple of weeks ago who told me that they had run the story around Occupy Wall Street for 4 days in a row, which they never run any story, the same story, 4 days in a row. And so she was saying, you know, this is something really significant because we never do this. On the other hand, she said, yes, but if we want to run it a fifth day, we need a new angle, and that new angle has to be where their demands. You know, so there is this interesting pressure. You know, the media, the mainstream media now has no choice but to cover this story and to keep it in the news, which I think is really, really interesting, especially because they explicitly ignored it for the first 2 weeks.
I'm speaking with Dorian Warren of Columbia University's School of International Public Affairs. The demands issue is complex and divisive. On the one hand, the lack of demands has helped keep the thing together. Once you start getting specific, you know, you're going to get a lot of argument. On the other hand, working together on common goals is how people develop solidarity over the longer term and way of crossing social boundaries and overcoming difference. So how do we finesse this demands issue? What's your opinion on that?
So I think back here to, let's think for a second about the trajectory of the civil rights movement. So most people agree that it started roughly with Brown in the Brown decision in 1954, but really the Montgomery bus boycott in 1955. It's not like in 1955 the civil rights movement and the organizers had written out the Civil Rights Act or the Voting Rights Act in 1955, right? It took almost a decade to get to those legislative victories. But their demands were pretty clear nonetheless. It was end segregation, end Jim Crow, right? That's a pretty powerful demand, and they were going to engage in, and they did engage in direct action to end segregation, to end racism in very concrete but still broad places. So I think if we just think about that, so let me finish narrating the movement. So 55, Montgomery bus boycott. 1960 are the student sit-ins. 1961, the freedom rides. 1963, the March in Washington. I'm just doing the big hits. And then 1964, you get, you know, the legislative achievement, the Civil Rights Act, followed the next year by the Voting Rights Act. So that's a decade-long trajectory of a movement that engaged in a range of direct actions over time. The strategy shifted over time. There were fights internally to that movement, and there were different strategies when people disagreed. But you didn't get to the specific legislative, national legislative victory until much later. So I think that's one example of how long movement building and movements take to actually become successful, even if they don't have a very, very, very specific legislative demand early on. So
yeah, what you're outlining there, I mean, for example, segregation, Jim Crow, that stuff is very specific, whereas a lot of these demands are a little fuzzier. I mean, how does that play into it?
Well, I think, this is week five of...
I'm impatient, yes.
Yeah. But this is the problem, you know, this is the trade-off of direct democracy, right? And this very consensus-based process. It takes time. And I think, especially here in New York, but in all the cities that have their General Assemblies engaged in demand working groups and coming up with their demands, I think they're going to get there. I think they're trying to figure it out now. And it's not going to take, you know, 5 years or even a year. I think probably in the next 2 months they'll probably have something. But I do think, you know, saying the political system is corrupt and therefore it needs to change, or to say that inequality has gotten out of hand, we need to end, I know that's a crazy demand almost, right? End inequality, that would probably take a revolution. But I do think it's clear enough yet broad enough to still keep a large group of people invested in what the movement could do.
Now, there are some people who have been criticizing the movement for being too white and too many college students concerned about student debt and not enough people concerned about mass imprisonment. Then there's objections to the language around occupation coming from indigenous groups. What do you think of that? I mean, were we not paying attention to potentially significant fissures?
I do think the previous two populist movements, the populist movement of the 1890s, the populist movement of the 1930s, they both were successful in many ways, but they faltered also on the issue of race and racial exclusion. So I do think that is a concern we should keep at the top of the agenda in terms of making sure this movement is different and that it's inclusive as possible. But I think, and I do think that the criticism of the use of the term occupy and occupation, I do think it's an accurate criticism, especially from tribal governments, from Native American folks. However, and so I don't want to dismiss it, but I think the broad brush of saying, oh, this is a white movement, I just think it's actually wrong. I think if you look at the New York Occupy movement, I have gone to about three people of color caucus meetings. They're very active. They're like 50 people at each of these meetings. If you look at Oakland, if you look at lots of places, you see, you know, and there's this Occupy the Hood, which is sort of like the National People of Color Caucus, right? There are people that are actually engaged in this, and it's mostly young people of color that I think show the lie that this is just a white movement. And frankly, I don't care, to be honest, if it was some white anarchists who were like, you know, we're going to occupy Wall Street, and they went down there and they sparked this thing, who cares? On some level, the question is now, how do we get people engaged in figuring out that their fate is linked to the fate of everybody else that's experiencing this massive growth in inequality, that's experiencing no voice in the political system? How do we link people at this point to understand that they should stand in solidarity with the occupier, so to speak? That's the question.
One of the remarkable things to watch in the last few weeks is the way this movement is contagious in a good way. It's certainly an international trajectory from the Middle East to here, but also, you know, even just in New York City, we saw some people doing Occupy-style tactics at a meeting of the program panel on educational policy, Bloomberg's rubber stamp advisory group on the schools. On Friday, we're supposed to see a civil disobedience against a police precinct over stop and frisk in Brooklyn. Is this kind of contagion? Is this typical of social movements?
It is, but not as fast as this has moved across the country and across the world. And I do think that is the one big difference in this moment where social media is so ubiquitous, especially among people, let's say, 35 and under. I do think there is something about the speed in which this is spread, and precisely because social media is such a horizontal, flat, and democratic set of tools that people can share information really quickly, they can make decisions quickly, they can decide, they're empowered, they have autonomy to decide, okay, we're going to do a civil disobedience at this police precinct. So, and then recruit people immediately. So before, when we had to use telephones and letters and other forms of communication, the very fact that this is able to travel so fast in this social media era, I think is new and I think is really remarkable.
What is the possible mechanism by which this movement of people just occupying things, bodies in space, can actually change politics and policy? How do we get from this glorious moment of disruption to something that actually is truly transformative?
That is the million-dollar question, so to speak. And, you know, I do think one thing that has to be important and that is really unique about this movement is that it's process, it's democratic process. And in some ways, the process is the substance, but not fully. But I think the fact that people, it's open that enough that people can get engaged and people therefore feel a sense of ownership over this movement, I think is important. So that by the time the demands emerge from each of the cities, from each of the formations, I think you'll have people committed and loyal to the cause for a much longer time to actually see through some kind of policy or political change than other movements that we've seen that have been more top-down. So I'm actually really hopeful that this kind of structure to the movement, this much more democratic structure to the movement, will actually compel people to stay engaged in a way that, say, efforts that come out of D.C., you know, the liberal lefty think tanks in D.C. and organizations in D.C. that have no membership, essentially, or the ones that do are top-down and can't mobilize their own members because they're so top-down, even though they have the right policy goals. I think this could be really something different in that it could be transformative in terms of how much people engage and stay loyal and actually see the victories through, potentially.
Now, speaking of problematic top-down institutions, the unions. Now, some of our anarchist friends are disturbed by the union's interest in this movement. They don't trust the unions. They think they're ossified, you know, dinosaurs. What's your view? Could this energize the labor movement to doing something better, or are they just bringing up the rear?
Well, I do think they're bringing up the rear. However, you know, it's important to point out that many of the initial organizers of Occupy Wall Street explicitly reached out to the labor movement, but with some conditions, right? So they, you know, they said, "Hey, we want your support, resources, bodies, etc. But we do have a particular organizational structure, a democratic decision-making structure that we don't want you anywhere near." And I think that was the right call. labor was never going to spark this kind of a movement, but they can benefit from it in a couple of ways. One, they can learn from how you can organize yourself differently in a more democratic way that actually engages your members and gives workers ownership over their own unions. Secondly, you know, unions, the labor movement has been talking about these issues for a long time, to their credit, but they haven't gotten anywhere. And, you know, again, that's the same with lots of groups on the left who've been talking about these issues for the longest time. And I think they can all learn from Occupy Wall Street's structure, from the way in which this spread so quickly, from the fact that people feel ownership and are therefore willing to take risk and engage in direct action in a way that most union members, for instance, are not, because usually they just get an order from an officer that they need to turn out at some place. So I think this is actually a key moment in which this movement could potentially help to transform the labor movement to be something bigger and stronger and much more radical than it is now.
Finally, whatever happened to the Tea Party?
Well, you know, that's interesting because we tend to not take seriously the role of emotions in politics. And both the Tea Party and Occupy Wall Street, they're both motivated by anger, right, which is really interesting. But anger channeled in different ways. So the anger from the Tea Party was, you know, part of it was, a racial backlash anger at this black Muslim guy in the White House. Part of it was this, you know, this anger that political anger at that the liberals are taking over and somehow big government was going to take over their lives. Part of it was anger, I do think, at economic inequality and their own economic conditions, just channeled in the wrong direction and channeled in a destructive way. You know, showing up at Tea Party rallies or events with guns, right? And we never saw any kind of police presence at those events, right? Because those were seen as good Americans. When you look at Occupy Wall Street, people are motivated by anger too, but it's anger that wants to be transformative, that wants that has a vision of how democracy should work, that has a vision of how either capitalism or some other economic system should work. And it's an anger that so far has been constructive, that so far has been committed to nonviolent direct action. So to me, it's really, really interesting to see these two movements in tandem, as much as I've hated the initial comparisons. But I also think there's something here that's important, and that is the fact that most Americans agree with the Occupy Wall Street folks more so than they do the Tea Party. And I think that's also a good signal that people now understand in hindsight what the Tea Party was really all about versus what, you know, the Occupy Wall Street folks are trying to raise.
Yeah, there's lots of anger in both movements, but there's love in Occupy Wall Street, and I didn't see much love in the Tea Party.
That's right. And frankly, I think the Occupy movement is fun. There's culture to it, you know. There's a festiveness that you can be angry and you can demand justice and you can be transformative, but you don't have to be dour and upset about it too, right? You can actually have fun and make music, you know what I mean? There's soul to it in a way that is missing from the Tea Party movement that seems to just be all about anger and with violent overtones to it.
Yeah, Susie Bright once said to me that workers of the world unite is actually an erotic sentiment.
I'm down for that cause. I want to be part of that revolution.
That was Dorian Warren, a professor of political science at the School of International Public Affairs at Columbia University. In the interview, you may recall that Warren talked about the speed of transmission of social movements in an age of instant communication. A little example of that. Two friends of mine, Alex Vitale, who was on this show talking about cops the other week, and Penny Lewis, were able to organize a large demonstration against police brutality in front of NYPD headquarters, an influx of people I was actually surprised to see the cops tolerate. They organized that in just 3 or 4 days. Cyber activism is no substitute for the real thing, but it does make the real thing considerably easier. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, a bit of the third movement of Beethoven's Piano Trio No. 6, performed by Daniel Barenboim, Pinchas Zukerman, and Jacqueline Dupre. Till next week, bye.